Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we want you to join us here at 410-319-8888. Write to us here, talk@steinershow.org. You can also email me, as I said, talksteinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. Want to hear what you have to say about Ferguson. We are joined here today to have this conversation in the first part of our program with F. Michael Higginbotham, who is the dean of the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor, excuse me, of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, and Malik Hayes, Board President of the Baltimore Algebra Project. We'll join us in studio in just a moment. 410-319-8888 is the number here to join in this conversation. And we said that students are walking out today at 1 p.m. here at Morgan State University and across the country. We will be hearing from them shortly about their walkout. It's happening at universities across America as well. 410-319-8888 to please join us here with your thoughts. And there were protests that took place last week at universities across Baltimore, your students being among the lead on that.
Oh, absolutely, Mark.
And at the law school.
It's good to join you.
Good to have you here.
My students led a protest, peaceful protest at University of Baltimore. And I think it's very appropriate that you had language from James Baldwin and Abe Lincoln earlier in the program. They're perfect examples because they care deeply about racial justice, and they were uniters and not dividers. And I think the peaceful protesters at University of Baltimore, as well as around the country, are also uniters, not dividers. They stand with the Rosa Parks of the world, who demonstrated courage to stand up against the racial status quo. And it does take courage. So all the peaceful protesters around the country, I think deserve a great deal of credit for that. And I'm very disappointed in people that have recently criticized some of these protesters, such as the athletes on the St. Louis Rams, who yesterday protested peacefully before they came out on the field.
Right.
They protested, and there's a long history of black athletes doing just that. You know, they have a large stage, a world stage, and a big microphone, and people like Jack Johnson, Jackie Robinson, Tommy Smith and John Carlos, Muhammad Ali, these athletes from the St. Louis Rams are in that legacy, and they deserve credit.
I wish we could have seen some of the white brethren on the Rams walk on there with off the field with on the field with them with their hands up, but we did not. Malik Hayes is also in the studio, board president of the Baltimore Algebra Project. Good to see you, Malik. And online here, 410-319-8888. Let me go to Joseph Kent, who is one of the leaders of the protests and organizers here at Morgan State University, to talk about what's about to happen today. Joseph, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
How you doing today?
I'm very well, man. How are you?
Good. And yourself?
I'm well.
That's
so
good.
So talk about what is about to happen today.
Actually, we're getting Morgan State campus together for another protest on Cold Spring and Helen Road, just so that we can continue our message that we started on Tuesday and Wednesday, to send a message to the city to actually tell them that we are recognizing what's happening around the world, and we want justice, we want answers, and we're not giving up until we get a solution to this problem.
So what form is the protest going to take today? What are you going to do?
We started giving out flyers around the campus to let everyone know to come out. And we were going to block off Cold Spring and Helen Road and make it like a circle, block it off, and actually protest just to get messages across the city as far as, like, drivers that drive past, and, like, the media can actually, like, show it on TV to actually so everyone can find out actually what we're doing and what we're doing it for and our purpose.
So, and is this part of a national day of protest taking place on campuses across the country, or is this something that the Morgan students are just taking it on their own to do?
No, this is actually something that's going all the way across the country for, like, colleges. Like, we have a lot of colleges that's participating in this. We have BCCC, we have CCBC, we have Baltimore Community College. We have a lot of colleges that's actually participating in our protest today. We have Baltimore Block, and we also have the Anonymous organization. So
right,
So we actually, it's actually a ongoing thing around for like different organizations that we have put together.
We're also being joined on air here before we turn back to our studio guests, and please feel free to jump in, studio guests. We are also joined here by Chinedu Nwakufor, who is a another organizer, Morgan. Chinedu, welcome. Good to have you with us, too.
Hey, man. It's good to be on.
So tell me a bit about, I mean, we just we were talking a minute ago with another one of the organizers here, Joseph Kent. So I'm curious, I mean, what are you feeling is the tenor of the students at Morgan State University around this, and what do you expect today?
Hopefully we expect that our students heed the call and come out in support. But I think at this point, within Ferguson and beyond Ferguson, I think students are using this situation as a catalyst to show how much we're just tired of injustices in general. I mean, showing solidarity for Ferguson, but I think a lot of students are saying, you know, using this as a focal point, we should also start addressing the things that are happening within our campus as well.
And last week you had a protest, and also didn't Morgan students take part in the protest that went to City Hall?
Yes, Morgan State students actually, we basically, there was another protest going on in City Hall. We knew about that, but beforehand we had our own, you know, thing going on at Morgan State. We never knew it was going to become so big, but I mean, the students felt so involved because they felt like it affected them that they wanted to make it more than what we had planned. And the students wanted to march, and the students wanted to shut down the streets, and the students wanted to march from Morgan State to City Hall. It had nothing to do with any singular person, but it was a unified idea that enough has to be enough.
And in some ways, what you all and you and Joseph and the other students are doing, this is. I mean, it is very spontaneous. It's organized, but it's spontaneous, and it's just a feeling that's pushing. And I think it's important to have these young people's voices like yours and others out there. You can feel something bubbling up across the country. More, it happened at the University of Baltimore, happened with students at MICA, was happening with students at Morgan. What you think before we have to turn to our guest in the studio, what the significance of all this is for America, for the future, for your generation, for what we're fighting about in America?
I think it's we all say wake up.
Yeah.
Wake up. But the thing is, no one's really asleep.
That's it.
Everybody's
right.
Awake. And they're watching this. No one is sleeping. The wake up just symbolizes realize everything that you view every day. I mean, my teacher in the communications department always told me, you know, question why you like what you like and why you do what you do. And I think when students begin to question and become conscious, things like what happened on Tuesday happened, then they want to riot, then they want to rally. And I think, if I may say this to everybody, students have been very, very keen and kind lately. I think should this continue, students will get more riled up. And as spontaneous as it seems, a lot of these things are very, very schemed and they're planned. They're very, very planned out and thought out. And the students will continue to do whatever they feel is necessary until their voices are heard. And I think they will not take no for an answer. It's the spirit of our forefathers and those in the 60s and those in the 1800s that bleed within us, that make us feel like we have to do this, that this isn't second nature to us, that this is one with us.
Very well put. And let me, Josie, have a final thought before we turn to our guests here. And we're actually going to try to get you and some of the other students from Morgan on this program later in the week, along with students from MICA and Baltimore, to hear their stories as well. But, Joseph, a final thought? Okay, well, so anyway, we really appreciate both Joseph Kent and Chinedu Nwakufor joining us here to talk about the protest today at 1 o'clock, students walking out. And, Raleigh, this is part of a world that you're part of.
Oh, I'm definitely part of it. I am also a part of the Baltimore Block now. I've joined up with them, and I've been working with Joseph on organizing for today. Ferguson is everywhere, and that is a hashtag. That's a statement. It's because, you know, all these issues are everywhere. And it's like the brother said, you know, it's kind of a wake-up moment, but people haven't been asleep. I think it's more so people are realizing that every single body, every single voice counts. And they're feeling it's their duty to protest. It's their duty to come out and, you know, show what they believe in and raise their voices for that. And so that's why these protests are sparking up all across the world. When they did, in response to the no indictment decision, you know, 38 out of 50 states had protests that next day. If that doesn't show you that the rest of this country alone is watching. And it's not even getting into the fact that, you know, countries all across the world had solidarity marches for their own issues, but also, you know, saying we support Ferguson because their issues are our issues are their issues. The whole world is holding its breath and watching this movement because this is a movement.
And I know the law students kind of took hold of this at Baltimore, and there were students who were working in art and social issues at MICA that took hold of this. The MICA students had also walked out. As an old prof, what's your sense of this, Michael?
Well, my sense is one that the students deserve a lot of credit, students all around the country. But I do think it's more than simply students. I think a lot of Americans are not only protesting but are in support of what this protest stands for. I do think that there are a lot of Americans that are asleep on this issue of racial injustice. And, you know, we've made a lot of progress in the country. We have a black president today, and I think a lot of people are saying, you know, the racial injustice doesn't exist anymore. And I think this is a wake-up call for a lot of Americans. And I think what is most significant is, and this is what one of the protesters mentioned, what is this all about? You know, once we wake up all of America, what is this all about? And what are we going to do with this moment in history? And I think it's very critical that we focus on changes. What concrete things can be done once Americans begin to focus on Ferguson and the problems that exist, not only in Ferguson, but throughout the country?
Let me get a call in here before we go to break at 410-319-8888. And Yemma, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yes. Thank you. What I think is very interesting is we see a replication of the same things we saw during the Martin Luther King era. We see a pivotal moment which has been supported by moments before cause an outbreak. But what I want to point out is it was the youth of America. It was not the family, mothers, the fathers who went out and marched. It was the children
right.
who were the catalyst for the changes. And it was also the international outrage at the way that Americans were treating black people. Now, I want to also say that I think it's really interesting that we don't focus on a very important thing. We do not have any kind of way, a reporting mechanism for showing how many black people have been killed by the policemen across this country. There's no central reporting agency. We only hear about it when the family makes an uproar or when something like this happens, and that's important. And secondly, I want to say that even though we talk about black-on-black crime, white-on-white crime, they have not been sworn to protect us. Policemen
right.
have taken an oath to protect us. And when they step outside that oath and instead we become their victims, then we truly have a problem. And finally, can we please have some women talking about these issues? Because as we know, even though we think about Martin Luther King, there were hundreds of thousands of women.
No, the movement would not happen without women. Let me just say that there were women on this panel. One dropped out at the last minute. This morning, someone else is coming on in the next part of this program as well. But I agree with you completely. We always try to have women in every panel that we do here, if not in the majority often, because I agree with you completely. Women's voices have to be heard because I think the fight here is against racism and patriarchy in our world, and they fit neatly together in terms of what we're trying to do. And I take that critique right now, Yemma, to heart, and I'm sorry that the guests that we had planned here in this segment couldn't join us at the last minute. We're about to go to break, but
I just wanted to cut in and say that ultimately women are at the forefront of this movement.
They are,
particularly around like the Black Lives Matter hashtag. You know, my women I consider my big sisters, Alicia, Opal, and Patrice. They started that movement. They put in work in Ferguson, and in Ferguson, there's women mostly at the forefront. And so, women are definitely at the forefront of this movement, and people like me will definitely continue to make sure they stay there.
So we'll take a brief break. We're going to come right back with our guests. We're going to look also in this next half an hour, for a bit of our next half hour, around the issue of grand juries and what's going on with grand juries, and why there's been so much critique of what happened with this grand jury in Ferguson, what that says for the future. And we're going to break with Tobacco Road. by the great Lou Rawls. Born on this day in 1935, the three-time Grammy winner, 40 million records sold during his career over 60 years. So, the great Lou Rawls, Tobacco Road, happy birthday.
To die or grow in the middle of Tobacco Road. I grew up in a rusty shack.
That grace founded on two-thirds a person, rapings and beatings and suffering that worsens. Black human packages tied up in strings. Black rage can come from all these kinds of things. Black rage found.
That's the great Lauryn Hill with Black Rage. The singer dedicated this song to those fighting for racial equality in Ferguson, Missouri. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and I'm here with Michael Higginbotham, the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America, Raleigh Hayes, Board President of the Baltimore Algebra Project. And we're joined for this segment by Walter Olson, who is Senior Fellow at the Cato Institute, Center for Constitutional Studies, who wrote a decision about the Ferguson Grand Jury. And Walter, welcome to the program. Good to have you with us.
Thank you.
And you also can join us here at 410-319-8888. Let me get a quick comment from a listener who's been holding on. Then we'll go right to Walter and all of us here to talk about this grand jury decision that was questioned by so many people around the country, conservative, liberal, left, all kind of criticized this decision. We'll talk about why. 410-319-8888. But first, Stacy from Baltimore, your thoughts. Hi, Stacy, welcome.
Start by thanks. Saying that you have just always had such a comprehensive knowledge base of this subject, and being a white man, I wish that you could be on a national forum to be able to mediate some of these discussions.
Oh, thank you, Stacey.
I do want to say that it is definitely a movement, and I will say that it is generational. I'm only 38, and my generation is not involved. This is the millennials, and they are serious. I follow Twitter. They are organized, and it is international. I've seen solidarity from Brazil, from China. And I also want to say something that not too many people are entertaining. This frustration and the anger that a lot of young black youth feel can be directly related to an increase in the recruiting for ISIS. What people are leaving alone is that this environment is ripe for something like that. So America really needs to entertain the idea of these type of environments inviting other international problems into our country if we don't take care of our own. And other and my next point is separate from that. People who aren't of color really need to stop making judgment calls about how black people do this and what we feel and how we should protest and how peaceful we should be. They really should stop making decisions and just not say anything about it because they don't understand. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Stacey, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to wrestle with some of the things you said in a few minutes, but I want to real quick and really join this as well with Michael Higginbotham and Walter Olson here to talk about this grand jury decision, which left, I mean, a lot of questions from the very moment it was done and in the time of day it was done and how this came in. So I'm curious, Walter, if you could just begin by talking about your critique.
Okay, well, I think for most of us who've followed this sort of issue, the shocking thing was how unsurprising it was that there was no indictment, because in general, grand juries are where police excessive force charges go to die. They do not come out with indictments. They are an institution that is guided by the prosecutors, and the prosecutors generally do not want to see an indictment. And so we went through a script that has unfortunately become very familiar around the country, all sorts of communities, all sorts of situations where the community may be in an outcry about police shooting, but it goes to the grand jury and nothing comes back out.
And one of the things that really shocked me about this decision, and even going to a grand jury, even though it happened here in Baltimore around the death of Tyrone West, Anthony Anderson, I believe, Anthony Anderson's death at the hands of police, On a state level, it's really not common for prosecutors to go to grand juries first. They usually bring charges through a preliminary hearing, and then it goes to court. So I'm just curious about what the whole process of the political process of grand juries, Michael.
Well, the prosecutor runs the grand jury, and I agree with the comments made earlier that in these kinds of situations, because prosecutors work closely with police, they generally don't want to see an indictment made against the police in a shooting of a civilian. And so, unfortunately, this is par for the course. Now, there's a lot of criticism of grand juries in general, and this one in particular, with respect to police use of force. And that's because the prosecutor in this case went overboard, I think, in the sense of he really should have recused himself, not necessarily because of the presence of bias, although I think there can be an argument made, mm-hmm. but because of the appearance of bias with respect to his history, personal history, where his father was killed in the line of duty by a black perpetrator. And I think that gave an appearance of impropriety where he should have recused himself. And so I think from the outset, this grand jury had a real appearance of impropriety problem, and a special prosecutor should have been appointed.
Now, from the comments he made that evening, and really feel free to ask a question and jump in here with our two guests, I want you to do that, that the witnesses, it seemed as if the prosecutor handed this over to two other people to do, that witnesses who supported Wilson's testimony were believed and the kind of not challenged, but other witnesses who did not support what the Officer Wilson said were really challenged, one of them being this, I read as I was reading the grand jury testimony, one of them was this juror number 10, I believe it was, who was a worker that day watching from one of the apartment buildings as it happened, and talked about seeing, he was fixing drain pipes and seeing Michael Brown say something like, I quit, and then being shot. Now, then he was challenged on that, saying, but you don't know what really happened because you didn't see Officer Wilson. He said, no, I didn't, but this is what I heard, is what it meant to me. And but so those were challenged. I wonder, there seems to have been in this case, at least from some people's perspective, Walter Olson, kind of a very lopsided way of conducting a grand jury.
Well, Wilson had the advantages of having a defense lawyer present at the grand jury in the guise of the prosecution side, and that's, you know, you can argue all day about whether it would be fairer if people got a defense lawyer, but the truth is that in the overwhelming majority of grand jury proceedings, it's the other way around. There is someone trying to get an indictment, and there is no one arguing from the other side. So, again, this no surprise to those who have watched this kind of case go to grand juries in the past, but very real fairness questions that we have a chance to have a public debate about. Grand juries are not still a very well-known institution, and so this sort of stuff has been
right.
sliding by for years with very little public debate.
Now, talk about that a bit more. What do you mean it's not a well-known institution, and what it was, we do not know about this, we should know about this?
Well, to begin with, this was an exception because usually the process is secret, and parts of this remain secret in that they're not supposed to reveal the names of the grand jurors, but this was exceptional in that at least they released the transcript. Now, imagine if you are a family, for example, that is trying to get answers in a more ordinary grand jury process, and they won't even release the transcript. All you know is that they never indicted the officer. So unlike most court processes, which result in a transcript that reporters can sift through, this one usually doesn't. And beyond that, the it's historically hallowed in some ways, in that we inherited this, and at one point it was an important check against the crown, if you go back far enough, or the power of prosecution. And as it changed, and as it turned into something that just could be used either way by prosecutors, it became inside baseball. Lawyers know about it, but you've got to be something of a criminal procedure buff in order to
right.
to know about this. And you know, court TV and the various other things that have educated people about other parts of the process don't reach in there.
It is a very shadowy thing. I think most lawyers, non-lawyers, as he was saying, Michael Higginbotham, do not understand. It's interesting that a couple of things happened here in this case that really kind of were shocking to me. That Kathy Alizeda, I think I pronounced her name correctly, who were the assistant prosecutors, passed out a statute to the grand jury describing law enforcement officers' use of force in making an arrest, and it was based on a 1979 Missouri law that was overturned by the Supreme Court in 1985 that was not even an act of law in Missouri. But she used that to say this is almost as justification for what Officer Wilson did. And on top of that, you were talking about it had to do with how you are allowed to shoot a fleeing suspect, and that was overturned by the Supreme Court in 85. But she presented that as law. And that Bob McCullough himself, you're talking about recusing himself, is president of a group called the Backstoppers Incorporated, which is there to assist families for those who gave the sacrifice in line of duty who are police officers. And that group was raising money to support Officer Wilson with T-shirts, and some of the funds were given to Darren Wilson's fund. None of that came out. I mean, these are the kind of things that I think that make the process unseemly at best.
I think the process appeared to be problematic, unseemly, and in reality it probably was. As was pointed out, it appeared that McCullough was a defense attorney almost for Wilson, the police officer, and that is really unusual. The grand jury is generally a secret organization. It's kept, you know, the proceedings are kept quiet. But in this case, all the information was released, but there was no sort of questioning of Wilson in terms of his presentation. He made an hour or two presentation, and there were no questions to Wilson questioning his position and what he articulated as to whether or not he was in reasonable fear of his life. And so I think it all gives the real problematic appearance here, and I think that's part of why people are so upset and they're protesting, because what would have been easy to do would have been either to not have a grand jury, to have a special prosecutor appointed, or to send this to for the grand jury to send it to a jury to have a jury trial on this. And that was not done. And I think if it had been done, maybe you'd have different approaches today.
Well, what's your thought on that, and also on the use or overuse even of grand juries in our culture, in our society?
Well, a lot of what Michael was just saying falls into the same category, which is it was not an adversarial process. And to the extent that we trust our court system, and we don't always trust everything that it does, but a lot of the trust comes from there being an adversarial process in which a lawyer can pop up and, for example, argue for a recusal. It doesn't mean that he'll get it, but it means that you compare it with some standard for recusal and you get the sense that you know, that there has been an official determination of whether the person is conflicted enough that they need to withdraw. Or in the very interesting development about whether they were stating the legal standard correctly, and this was confusing to those of us on the outside because Missouri has a very, very pro-police standard for excessive force, but it's been modified by the fact that Tennessee versus Gardner, the Supreme Court decision, clearly ruled out some of it. Well, where did they come down in between? We found out much later that they didn't correct the jury's impression until the last minute. Now, if there had been an adversary process there with two lawyers, the other lawyer, with any competence and any professional standard would have popped up and insisted on a clarification of that much earlier. So when you don't have lawyers arguing from both sides, you wind up with either mistakes or worse than mistakes being uncorrected, and that happened here again.
Well, if you had a question?
Yeah, so let's talk about the fact that in the process, the prosecutor decided to release all the information to the grand jury instead of just enough to get an indictment. Right, that is a serious issue where there were already conflicting accounts in the evidence, and you're purposefully, you know, confusing jurors. Like that's one of the issues. And then I want to kind of jump ahead a little bit. And then in his statement where he pretty much blamed social media, the 24-hour news cycle, just pretty much people paying attention to what's going on and kind of eroding the secrecy of a normal grand jury into why, you know, things played out that way. And to me, that makes no type of logical sense. It really, like, just kind of to jump back to what Michael said, you know, I won't use the word appearance. I will say that the prosecutor's office of Missouri were the defense attorneys for Darren Wilson. It just makes no type of sense. And with any of the legal experts I've talked to, how this was carried out.
And I let me get a caller in here to ask questions of you all while Walter's still with us at 410-319-8888. Donna in Baltimore, you're on the air. Welcome.
How you doing, Mark?
Very well. Welcome.
Enjoying your show.
Thank you.
I have two questions.
Mm-hmm.
What role would the federal government and the Justice Department be able to investigate to see whether there was corruption and conflict of interest with the grand jury, the whole how they did it? Because it appears they treated it as if it was an actual trial than more of a grand jury. And my second question is, what needs to be done to change the policies at the federal level that will stop this, you know, Bill of Rights, where these police officers can do this type, use this aggressive force against, you know, people, period, whether it's African-Americans, men, women, whatever, because there has to be policy changes to stop this because it's been going on for so long. And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Thank you. So what can the federal government do in all this?
Well, the role of the federal government is limited in terms of enforcement. Their limitations go back to federal civil rights laws that allow them to allow the Justice Department to investigate the police departments and to determine whether they are violating the civil rights, the federal civil rights of individuals. And that's a very limited role. And you're seeing Attorney General Holder conducting an investigation right now of the Ferguson Police Department and of what occurred in Ferguson. But it's very limited. The primary responsibility for law enforcement is a state and local aspect. And that's what you're seeing playing out.
Walter, any thoughts on that?
Yeah. And the Justice Department has signaled that it is probably not going to intervene in a way that would change the outcome in Officer Wilson's case. What it is more likely to do is to come up with some negotiated future-looking settlement with the department in which it would change its future procedures.
So, well, Walter, I'm come to a conclusion for us with this from your perspective on where this takes a national discussion around the grand juries and around how we address cases like this.
Well, it has educated everyone about things that they didn't know very well until a few weeks ago. Where it will go from there is very much up in the air, because public sentiment is extremely pro-police in many places. And, you know, one of the things we haven't mentioned in this half hour is, will the voters in St. Louis County want to do things any differently? McCullough will be up for re-election. Will they elect a new crew to anything out of discontent from this, or will they rally around the police, as has happened in earlier cases, even when it seemed egregious? You know, will reaction to public disturbance and rioting, you know, result in a backlash? That's going to play out differently in different parts of the country. Mm-hmm. You know, this will inspire some people and to elect new people in some cities, but whether St. Louis County is one of them, I don't know.
I think that's a very important point, that prosecutors are elected. And so the electoral process can play a role here. It'll be interesting to see what happens when McCullough runs again, whether he'll be reelected, whether there will be tremendous support for what he did on this, or whether this will be his downfall. I also think, though, that there are some important things that can be done on a national level as well as a local level. One is one of your earlier callers wanted to know about statistics. We need a national data collection to go on with respect to uses of force, particularly involving racial oppression. So we really need to have the data collected on that so we can see, we can make some informed judgments. I think everybody's talking about body cameras on police officers, and clearly the federal government could provide funds to see that that happens on local levels where particularly the police departments don't have a lot of money. I think there's tremendous agreement on that, and I think that some police forces were reluctant to go along with that, but I think now there's going to be tremendous uniformity in terms of body cameras on all police. I heard that the mayor of Ferguson ordered civilian review procedures to take place. I think that's a good idea. When you have uses of force by the police to have civilian review boards. But I think it's also important that those civilian review boards have power, have authority, not just advisory, but some real power to, in fact, demote people, to fire them, to take their jobs away from them. I think there's a lot of civilian review boards that just don't have the power. And so that's a few things that can be done.
A week before last Wednesday, we played parts of a large town meeting that I moderated about civilian review boards. And one of the guests there was the head of the Toronto Civilian Review Board. And he came down from Canada for this conversation, which took place at the Real News. And there in Toronto, the Civilian Review Board has the power to hire and fire the head of the police department and to determine whether or not a police should or should not be prosecuted for anything that may happen on the 4th with excessive force and others. It's actually a department with teeth. There are other communities in America. D.C. is attempting, and Cincinnati are attempting to do that. I mean, I think that's another question of kind of local power, Walter Olson, that is kind of critical to this discussion as well.
Yeah, I was fascinated. There's an excellent article in The Nation magazine by Chase Medar a few days ago going through each of the possible reforms and remedies, and he concluded that at least in the United States, civilian review boards, which remember have been around for 40, 50 years or more,
right,
have not lived up to their promise, have not in fact performed very well. Now, one of the key questions that you raise about Toronto is, can they intervene in the job situation for the officers? You know, if they can't even get an officer fired, then they are a toothless civilian review board, and you run smack into the power of the police unions, which, you know, that first and foremost are trying to make sure they have no power over employment. Let me put in a plug, if I could, for my own Cato Institute, because it runs something called the National Police Misconduct Reporting Project, which is not a statistically full database, but is the fullest one based on reports from around the country of charges of police misconduct. And although it is not as good as a public database would be, it is still full of interesting information for those trying to grasp this problem.
So my response to how can we, make change is that, one, every individual needs to take a step up and find their place in the movement. That does not mean you have to be on the front lines out protesting, because that's not everybody's mm-hmm. place. But it does mean that everybody that is of age to vote, and even if you're not, there needs to be a culture shift. There needs to be a shift around us, one, understanding that we each have power, right? We need to be able to say, we are going to control these communities. We're going to build our own legislation, and that our representatives are really just pass-throughs for what we want. We need to say that we're going to grow our own representatives. We also need to understand that we have to have our own systems of making this sustainable. We have to do this in a way that shows that we're not going to take this anymore, because if we continue to be passive, this will just continue. That is ultimately what will happen. And so that is, again, what this movement is showing, is that people are tired. People have been tired for years, right? Nothing worth getting has ever happened without people working very hard for it.
And I think it's a question also how that gets mobilized. One of the things I think about with Walter Olson, your work at the Cato Institute, which is a fascinating think tank, a libertarian think tank. That's fair to say, right, Walter?
Yeah.
Okay. That in the history of the United States, the only way that civil rights, especially in the African American community, has happened is because of intervention. After grassroots movements from the bottom forced the intervention of the federal government to pass certain laws to begin to ensure those civil rights. But you see something different going on in America now, the bubbling up again from the bottom, with kind of less power in some ways for the federal government, especially with the sitting Supreme Court that exists today. And that does have to happen locally, which means that there's got to be a way for people on the ground to organize together to make that happen, or it will never happen. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean, I think we're seeing a really kind of – there could be a shift taking place, which we can rest with in the next half an hour, because when Walter brought up, will they throw out the prosecutor in St. Louis County, or will he remain? And that's a big if. In Baltimore City here, where we're broadcasting from, that in fact did happen. When people mobilized in this community, not many people came out, but the people who did come out voted out the local state's attorney, in part around issues of excessive force by the city police. And I think that – so it'll be different in different communities. But I think that's going to be a piece we'll wrestle with in the next hour on the program, because I think where do we go from here in America? And this could be a very different paradigm that we're dealing with in the 21st century than we did in the 20th or the 19th century.
I personally think a multi-tiered approach is the appropriate one. That is also grassroots protest, but as well as change from the legislative, judicial, and executive branches. I think we need it all, and I think it's important. And I think that the grassroots movement can move, of course, the legislative and executive to act faster and better.
A final thought from you, Walter Olson, before we have to take a break here.
On this kind of locally driven issue, and you're quite right that it's going to develop very differently from place to place, one of the first questions I always ask is, all right, who's doing it right? Who's got the best example of the right kind of reform? And I have to say it was discouraging when you had to turn to Toronto, a different country. I wish there were an American example.
I wish there were more American examples, but it's hard to find them. But I think that example of having him down here to talk about that with citizens, and it was interesting – The police officers at that meeting, which we broadcast here a week and a half ago, well, they were only African-American police officers, I may add, and that showed up for that meeting, supported the idea of a civilian review board with teeth that could actually do something. I think so there is a move afoot. But first of all, I want to thank my guest here, Walter Olson. It's always great to have you with us, senior fellow at the Cato Institute Center for Constitutional Studies. We'll be linking to his what he wrote about in terms of the decision of the Ferguson grand jury. Walter, once again, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Willie Kayes will be staying with us, I think, for a bit here, coming into the second hour as we come back to this conversation with other guests. Michael Higginbotham will remain with us as well for the next hour. We're going to take a brief break. When we come back, we are joined by Lynn McAllister and Alexis Johnson. And Alexis Johnson, we're looking forward to having her here on the program as Executive Director of the Perception Institute and the work they're doing around race in America. She's also chair of the Planned Parenthood of America, so she'll be joining us in the next hour as well. So please stay with us. We'll be right back, and we are going to break with what? With Alone Again, Naturally, by singer-songwriter Gilbert O'Sullivan, born on this day in 1946. We'll be right back.
We may as well go home, as I did on my own, alone again, naturally. Think that only yesterday I was cheerful, bright and gay, looking forward to what wouldn't do the role I was about to play. But as if tonight.
Me and Mrs. Jones. Got a thing going on. We both know that it's wrong.
Welcome back, and that's Me and Mrs. Jones by the great Billy Paul. That single hit the chart today, went to 2 million copies. So, Billy Paul on this day in history, our music interludes. We are here with our guests, again, looking at Ferguson and what will happen next in this country. And we have a lot of interesting questions lined up from people who have been writing in. We want to get your thoughts at 410-319-8888, 410-319-8888, or write to me, as I said, talk@signershow.org. You can also tweet me at Mark Steiner, 410-319-8888. Remaining with me are F. Michael Higginbotham, Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Raleigh Hayes is Board President of the Baltimore Algebra Project, who has spent time in Ferguson, Missouri, as has Michelle Zay, a former intern producer on this program, who has been doing work as a journalist and activist in Ferguson. Alexis McGill Johnson is with us. She's Executive Director of the Perception Institute, a consortium of researchers, educators, and social justice advocates whose work analyzes the role of bias and racial anxiety in our society, and is currently putting out a series of reports called The Science of Equality, which are fascinating, looking at brain science research and discrimination in the United States, which we will do an entire show by itself. And she currently serves as chair of the Planned Parenthood Federation of America. And Alexis, welcome. Good to have you with us as well. Glad you could join us.
Thank you for having me.
And Linda McAllister is on the phone as well, Republican strategist, former congressional candidate, currently a host of Night Talk, Get to the Point, on the Pittsburgh Cable News Channel, and host of Get It Right with Linda McAllister. And you can see his work at LindaMcAllister.com that we will also hit as well. And Lenny, good to have you back with us.
Mark, always enjoy being on with you.
And I promise one of these Saturdays I'll be able to get on your show, but Saturdays are tough, but I will try.
We'll make it work. We'll definitely make it work indeed.
410-319-8888 is the number here. But let me begin with where this goes from here. We heard earlier from students from Morgan State University that are one of a group of students from across Baltimore and across this nation that are walking out of their classrooms today at 1 o'clock. It's a very complex question about where this goes and where this takes us. And Alexis, I'd like to start with you, if I might. Just talking about what you, given the work you've been doing, seeing the tenor of race and racism in America, the complexity of it, where the tragic situation in Ferguson may take us in terms of change.
Well, you know, I think there have been a couple of lessons that we've seen with Ferguson. The first is that, you know, over the last couple of years with the deaths of Trayvon Martin and Jordan Davis and John Crawford, it's felt like we've had these individual rallying moments, and it's been very difficult to tie them to broad systemic challenges that you know we know exist, particularly in the criminal justice system with respect to men of color. And I think what's happening right now around Michael Brown and Ferguson is that it's becoming more of a systemic conversation. It's becoming more movement driven, which requires more of a systemic solution. And so I'm really energized by the young people. I feel like they are, you know, they are bringing, you know, the right lens to the work, I think, or to the cause, I guess. I think that the challenge in terms of the what next is how to cohere these into something that doesn't just kind of put pressure on the system and identify like the very clear kind of, you know, moving beyond just police having body cams, like, you know, what are the clear asks of the state, but also in identifying tactics that will help us reach across the bridge, that we're very polarized in this nation, particularly when it comes to race. We're very polarized between communities, you know, policing communities and the communities that they serve. How can we identify protests and movements that will actually help us move beyond that divide and begin to work through, you know, solutions which I think most Americans really would support.
And let's wrestle with that for a bit, because I also think that there's all this research out there at the moment that shows there is a huge divide around race in America, perceptions on race, and not just perceptions on race, but around racism and what fuels and motivates people both consciously and unconsciously in this country. You also see in those same pieces come out, Pew studies and the others that have come out, research polls, that 25-30% of white Americans, mostly younger Americans, see racism as a problem and see police brutality against people of color as a problem that has to be dealt with. So while there is this huge split in our country, there seems to me in some senses also in some ways a sign for hope that that change can take place, or at least there is a body of people in America that want to see that. It may, in fact, even be the majority of people in America, not a minority of the people in America.
Yeah, I do think that there are a majority of people who really have, if you look at any index around kind of where people stand on equality and egalitarianism in this country, 85% of Americans believe that we should be treated equal, that discrimination is bad, that we need to identify when we see problems in the system, we need to fix them and correct for them because they know that discrimination is counter to the opportunity that they believe America holds for everyone. I think the unconscious bias piece is also a very strong impulse, right? We, our kind of biases, which are negative stereotypes that have become embedded in our brains, that Americans, white, black, Latino, we all hold with respect to each other, but particularly around anti-black bias, is something we also have to become more aware of and identify ways to correct for. And we can do it by different spheres, right? I mean, there's great work, great research happening in police departments across the country, with communities, training officers around how to recognize not just their implicit bias, but also their racial anxiety, right? Kind of what makes their brains shut down and go into fight or flight mode because they're afraid that if they do something, they'll confirm themselves as biased or racist. And I think bringing that to people's attention, whether you're talking about police officers or educators or doctors, I think it's been a really important move with respect to race in this country. And I think the more we can rely on the research of how our bodies are working around race, I think the better off we'll be.
Your thoughts on what you're hearing Alexis kind of bring to this table. Lenny?
I agree. I mean, there's nothing really to disagree about, and I think this is one of the things that, and Mark, you and I have talked about this over the years, that this is where these type of situations become politicized in ways that they shouldn't be. And if you're a constitutionally based conservative, you should believe in the defense of civil rights for all Americans, including African Americans, including young African American males in urban America. And what we're finding is that time and time again, there's a de facto second-class citizenship that is unacceptable and is un-American. And at some point in time, if we're trying to be the greatest nation on the face of the earth for the next 100 years, from an economic standpoint, from a cultural standpoint and the like, we have to eradicate this type of accepted reality within urban America and within many communities throughout America. This is not just a Ferguson incident. This is a New York City incident with Eric Garner. This is a Pittsburgh incident with Leon Ford Jr. This is a Los Angeles incident with Ezell Ford. So these are the types of things that we have to be very mindful of, and it's more than a conversation. At some point in time, and this is where the challenge is now with Ferguson, we can't continue to have conversations. We have these nice, touchy-feely conversations where people hug each other and shake each other's hands for about 3 weeks, and then we go back to the same de facto duality. That is unacceptable. We have to see progress. There needs to be asks that are met. There needs to be demands that are met. And if it means shaking up the paradigm in a very fundamental way over the next coming months, this is something that can't just be for the next couple of weeks. This needs to be a months and maybe even years movement so that we can get positive, permanent change in our society. And again, as a constitutionally based conservative, this should be something that you're lockstep with the civil rights community. And if you're not, you're making this about political ideologies where it really shouldn't be.
So let me bring in Michelle Zay and Raleigh Hayes back here, because both of these, you've both been the Ferguson, you've both been part of this movement of younger people in our country that are taking hold of this. And I'm curious what you've seen in Ferguson, what you see around the country, and where you think this, where the point of this new movement is going, and how it's going to proceed. Michelle?
Well, I think, first of all, it's the approach in Ferguson, which is the heartbeat, really, of all this mobilization around the country, is very multifaceted. So, you see people protesting in these traditional forms of taking to the streets. But I think moving forward, one of the biggest shifts that I've witnessed is millennials kind of starting to raise consumer awareness as well. So I think one of the most powerful actions just happened to be good timing in terms of when the grand jury decision came out was the Blackout Friday and the Blackout Weekend, and even, that action continued into just the holiday season in general is a really important aspect of the movement, because it's starting to raise consumer awareness. And, you know, in a capitalistic society, that's incredibly important. And I think especially for millennials, where, you know, we're a huge market. And I think us starting to voice our opinions politically, but also economically, is incredibly important. And when you look at past movements, you know, that makes a huge impact, because these moral arguments don't always resonate with people in power. And I think especially in terms of the criticism of rioting or young people being disorganized, when you look at the action that took place this last weekend, it's incredibly powerful, and I think definitely reflects this multifaceted approach and shows that the leadership in Ferguson and the leadership in other cities are definitely looking at different segments of society that need to be involved or need to be awakened and need to be held accountable around these issues.
I definitely agree with Michelle. I have a few points I want to address. So first off is that on the racial divide in America, this isn't anything new. It's always been the young people who have always pushed for change. Again, during the civil rights movement, you have SNCC, which was comprised mostly of young people, college students, and they push for change. Then you have now, where it's mostly younger people pushing, and that is, they're pushing back on the older generation and saying, you know, reconsider what you seem to believe. And some people change, some people don't. But that's not the important thing. The important thing is that moving forward, those who will inherit the country and the reins of power are pushing for change. And then also, where do we go from here? This movement is still actually very young. We're at, I think, day 117. This movement is very young, but it's maturing. It's growing. Their tactics are becoming more complex. And I think as an organizer, Blackout Black Friday was a wonderful thing. I think the numbers were down by 11% this year, which means money-wise, that's hundreds of millions of dollars that they expected to come in that didn't come in. As an organizer, I think this weekend was honestly a test to see just how well we could do a boycott and how well we could speak economics. And I think that it will continue and it will become more complex and it will become more sustained as we move on, because the holiday season is here. And just thinking as an organizer, thinking strategy, it makes perfect sense to continue this movement. I know a lot of people complain that, boycott in one day doesn't do much. But I think it made a statement and it showed people just how, you know, even non-action of not buying.
I mean, I find that very interesting, because all the reports I heard in the news beforehand were that this was going to be a banner Black Friday, and sales were going to be much better because people said they were going to buy. But instead, it was 11% down from last year in an economy that's better. And I don't know if the movement that's growing affected that, but I have a feeling it did, because people did take that seriously. I think that there is something afoot here, Alexis. And then I'm going to go back over to Michael a bit and get to the phones here, 410-319-8888. But I think that there is something afoot here, and I think that part of that movement has to be political from the ground up, because we're seeing these kind of movements taking place across America, and these decisions are being made locally, not necessarily nationally, and they're crossing racial lines that might heighten the contradictions of race, but also may help to change them.
Yeah, look, I mean, I think Blackout Black Friday and the work that will continue is, you know, really made the point of power, and I think particularly within our world, right? I think that we all see the power of it. The challenge moving forward is more of a strategic one, right? The media analysis has not gotten to the point where they, I mean, obviously it's only been a day or two, where they're even recognizing the impact that Blackout
right,
Black Friday
right,
had
right.
on the movement. And so we need, you know, the movement needs technicians. It needs, you know, and I certainly would never accuse these young people who are organizing out right now about not having strategy, because strategy is exactly what they have. But some of the finer points on how we build and tell the story in a way, particularly in a 24-hour news cycle, where it's constantly competing with the tension of other issues around an issue that people don't want to have a conversation about, is really important. And so thinking about how we quantify our impact and how we direct and focus the change in ways where it's not as clear cut as it was, you know, 50 years ago, you know, where the Jim Crow and the segregation laws were just, you know, so obvious and visible, and the animus was so palpable. You know, but I think the previous caller, previous speaker's point about, you know, young people will lead this. Martin Luther King was 26, right?
I mean,
like, young people are driving this, and I think particularly for those of us who have more access to the research or to the media, we have to be helping support the real impact and helping them quantify the impact of the work that they're doing.
And we also remember having been one of those people that you know, the phone's going to turn to Michael and to Lenny for our next caller, is that it was also the Ella Bakers of the world and the Bayard Rustins of the world, who together, along with young people, were part of this movement. And I think you're seeing that bubble up. It takes young people to organize. It gets to the streets and do the organizing to make it happen. 410-319-8888. Alan, you've been waiting a bit. You're on the air.
Good morning. How's everybody today?
Very well, Alan. Welcome.
Good morning.
I agree with you that it takes young people, frankly speaking, because if you don't have young people, what's going to happen is old folks are, well, for whatever reason, old folks get old. I mean, Roy, I heard Roy Innes on Sean Hannity, and Sean Hannity was lauding him with praise. And old people get old, and if you don't have a movement that's multi-generational but with young people as the driving force, what happens is you have a group of old people like myself telling young people what to do. But you also need to have a movement that's not red-baiting and not divisive. And I have to call out the quote-unquote new quote-unquote Black Panther Party for their condemning of quote-unquote outside agitators and particularly all things censored, that interviewed a cop in Ferguson who said, "What is Carl Dix doing here, outside agitator?" Okay, Carl Dix is a communist. So what? There have been communists in the civil rights movement beforehand. We can't let red baiting, and we can't let the fact that, according to another political activist, Greg Crone, the representative of the final call, had the police department's number on speed dial, which was calling whenever he saw any problems. So we can't let this kind of divisiveness break us up. We've got to move forward in a spirit of love and cooperation.
Alan, thank you so much.
I just want to say that in my experience, this movement has been very intersectional. It has been very comprehensive of all issues and people. And I think everybody has been welcomed in with love, as long as people understand that as this movement moves forward, everybody's issues have their place, but Black people are moving up for Black people's issues, and that others should move for their own issues, and we can work together towards all of that.
Let me go to Lenny and then to Michael, because Lenny, I know, is going to leave at the top of the hour, and so I'm going to get his voice in here, and Alexis and Michael will be here for the rest of the program as well. 410-319-8888. Lenny, why don't you pick up on that, and let's go to Alexis after that.
I think at some point in time, yeah, there's nothing wrong with African-Americans speaking up for African-American issues. They should be able to speak up for African-American issues across the diversity of our politics. I think we should be able to speak about some of these issues across the diversity of our socioeconomic statuses. I think that, unfortunately, what you see in America a lot of time is there's nothing wrong with people from the LGBT community speaking up on those issues, and there's nothing wrong with Latino Americans and people from Spanish-speaking cultures speaking up for their issues. But every time we bring up race in America, when it comes to African Americans, we have a good amount of folks, generally speaking, unfortunately, conservatives, and almost like a dog whistle, a lot of Black conservatives that speak up and say, "Why are we bringing up the race card? You're playing the race card." But we see all these statistics showing that the race card is not a boogeyman syndrome. This is something that's very real in American society. And if you want to keep America weakened domestically, you continue to allow these things to happen in our communities. And if you're weakened domestically, you can't be strong internationally. And I don't think people see the correlation. So even if you don't like talking about race, but you do love America, you have to address these issues.
Alexis?
Yeah, I mean, ditto. I think we can't not have these conversations. I think understanding and unpacking a little bit about kind of what a black issue is, what a gay issue is. I think the intersectionality piece is really important, that there are issues that affect communities disproportionately that we care about. These are, you know, we're talking about, you know, our children who are not allowed to be children anymore. They are being overaged. They are, whether we're talking about the classroom or, you know, in front of a police officer. And you know, our ability to rally around that, you know, it should be a broader, you know, American conversation, but it's certainly something that starts immediately because it hits us at home, and how we connect that and build that into, you know, particularly in an intersectional way, into the way these issues are affecting kind of our, you know, our peers in the LGBT movement or in the women's movement or in the immigration movement. I think it's very powerful, and I think it really shows where, you know, the direction of the country is moving.
Yeah, I mean, that in all the pain of this, one of the things that I look at a positive is the movement that is building in America, and we're going to keep Michelle and Malik around for the last half hour of the program, along with Michael, to kind of talk about that with all the people who are trying to call in right now. And I think that's a hugely positive piece. And I keep looking at the research that I've seen come out of different surveys of interviewing people around America. And I will say this again, that as a civil rights worker, somebody who's been in went through the movement a long time ago, and a person who's a student of history, never has there been a time in America where this large minority of white people in America are thinking about race in ways about how to change America in a positive sense. That, to me, is a positive step forward. And I think that's why I think you can see this movement bubbling up from below happening. I think it's going to be very critical. You can see it in the students in your classroom, Michael Gumbotham, who laid down the street outside the law school.
Absolutely. There's no question that it takes all kinds to lead to be involved in a movement in the United States. Old and young, strategists and activists, black, white, brown, yellow, red. It takes all kinds. You really want to make a difference in this country, get a multiracial coalition together, and you will make a huge difference. There's a picture going around about a police officer, white police officer in Ferguson, and a young black protester, and they're hugging. And I think it's an important symbol. It's a powerful symbol. But the question is, what do we do after the hug? And I think everybody has been sort of talking about that. Michael Brown is a symbol. Michael Brown is a symbol. And just like Emmett Till, just like Rodney King, like Eric Garner and Ezel Ford, he's a symbol of racial injustice in the country, in the criminal justice system. And so I think his name is going to be synonymous with those individuals in history. And I think what's going to happen is we need to act quickly on this moment in history. It is an important moment where people are coming together to protest. And I think we need to act on that and take advantage of this focus on attention.
So when we come back, let's wrestle with how you all, people in this movement here, see this change. I mean, I'll let you kind of have your thoughts on that picture as well. I can see your face moving. We'll let you come back about Malik. But first, I want to thank Alexis Miller-Johnson, Executive Director of the Perception Institute. And Alexis, I've been reading your report, and I'm looking forward to finishing the entire report and having you back on for an hour with others to talk about that.
That would be wonderful. Thank you so much.
I'm really, really amazed at the work, and it fits into something George Yancey was talking about on our program last week as we talked to a bunch of African-American philosophers about what happened at the National Book Awards, and he brought up the issue of this kind of biologically and neurologically how race is affecting America. So I look forward to having the conversation and having you back on very soon.
That sounds great. I look forward to it.
Thank you so much. I do, too. And my favorite Republican strategist on the planet Earth, Linda McAllister, always good to have you with us. Thank you.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Always. So we're going to take a very brief break, and we're going to come right back from this brief break with our guests in the studio here to continue this conversation, Raleigh Hayes, Michelle Zay, and, of course, Michael Higginbotham. And we are going to break here with where are we going? What are we doing? Here we are. Oh, how can I not know this? Test. Martha and the Vandellas, No Way to Run. Today is the anniversary of the group's farewell performance in Detroit, Michigan, on this day in 1972. The great Martha and the Vandellas, No Way to Run. No Way to Run, America. We're here. Right back. Don't go away.
I'm in denial. And it don't take no x-ray to see right through my smile. I know I'll be on the go. And it ain't no drink out there that can numb my soul. Oh no. All we wanna do is take the chains
off. Be free. J. Cole. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. Here on the Mark Steiner Show at 410-319-8888. Write to us here at talkatsteinershow.org. We're going to come to these phone calls. Coming in at 410-319-8888, we are here with F. Michael Higginbotham, the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghost of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in a Post-Racial America. Michelle Zay is in the studio, former intern producer here on the Mark Steiner Show, has been an activist around Ferguson, and both as a journalist and as an activist. And Raleigh Hayes is in the studio, board president of the Baltimore Algebra Project, who went to Ferguson once, twice?
Once now.
Once.
I plan to go back, though.
I'm sure you do. 410-319-8888 is the number here. But you and Michelle both wanted to have a comment about the photo that we were talking about before we went on the air. You were saying during the break. You want to start, Michelle, and then we'll go to Raleigh?
Yeah, sure. So I definitely had an issue with this photo. It was of a young boy crying in the arms of a white police officer in Portland, and you know, like other cities in the United States, the Portland police definitely, you know, responded with excessive force to protesters. So yeah, I mean, I just had an issue with it because I think overwhelmingly that's not the reality of the relationship between black youth and white officers. You know, it's great that officers are able to find like their sense of humanity sometimes when they're out there patrolling. But, you know, I don't think that that picture is a fair representation of our issues with or our state of race relations within the police system right now.
I definitely agree with Michelle. I have issues with that photo as well. It definitely has been co-opted and kind of people have been trying to use it as a way to calm the tension, particularly racial tension, saying, like, look, if this can happen, everything else is well around the country. When Portland not only did use excessive force hours after that photo was taken, right? That police officer was found by Anonymous to be a Darren Wilson supporter. Whether that's not true or not, I personally take stock in Anonymous.
I do sometimes. Not everything they do. I used to take total stock in Anonymous. Recently, I have had questions about them.
Yeah, like, I mean, I have questions about the information they release, but right. It wouldn't surprise me if he was a Darren Wilson supporter.
It might be.
Yeah. So that's my issues with these photos. It's one, that's not the first time that happened, but let's be completely honest. If I see a white cop walking towards me, the last thing I'm going to want to do is approach him, let alone hug him. When I see police, when I see the blue and red lights, and this is most African-Americans, there is a piece of terror that just goes straight through our heart. It doesn't matter if the police are behind us, if they're coming after us or not. It's just an instinctive reaction at this point. And that is the reality of the world we live in, and we need to be honest about it. We have not really ever really seriously addressed race in this country. And that is why, you know, this issue keeps popping up is because we refuse to seriously address it. Other countries have, like the Holocaust, that was addressed. It was dealt with. I mean, there's still issues around some stuff, but it was actually publicly talked about.
We don't publicly talk about it in America. You're right. But I mean, and things have changed over these last several hundred years in this country. But I think we're at another historical moment and precipice when it comes to how we define America and where we're going, and race at the heart of it. The contradictions I keep saying that I think arose ever since President Barack Obama was elected President of the United States of America. Whether you support Barack Obama is not the question. I'm talking about what the contradictions that really came to the fore of this country in a deeper way, and then around the killings of young black men, especially young black men at the hands of police officers, or as Josh E. Ross would say in this program, and the killings of young Indian men across America that never get talked about. On reservations across this country, but it has raises new questions. The question is, where does the movement and where do people take it from here? Let me go to our phones and jump back to what our listeners are saying at 410-319-8888. And I hope I have your name right. And Glord, you're on the air, line one.
Yes. Good morning. Yes, I'm sorry, I'm just tuning in, and I probably missed a lot of stuff. But my concern is because I'm a community activist as well. And I'm born and raised here in Baltimore City. I've been here, and I'm, you know, aware of the riots. that was going on with Martin Luther King, and I'd seen people destroying properties.
Right.
Stores, mom-and-pop stores. I have family members that had stores that was demolished as well. And when I heard what was going on at Morgan, I said, well, Morgan is university-educated folks, young people, you know, because they are our future, and I don't foresee a problem. But once I started watching the news where they was going down on 83, pulling down a fence to get to 83 and setting down cords and problems for, you know, for everybody, you know, and that's not a good thing. And then I'm glad that they didn't start burning up stuff again, because what I think what we need to do when they're doing rioting, I mean protesting, they need to separate and know who's who. Because down in Ferguson, people throwing stones and rocks and stuff. If you're in a crowd, if I'm in a crowd with a bunch of folks, I know who's throwing stuff. You can see who's throwing stuff. But nobody's pointing these people out, and that is totally wrong. Because all that's going to do is cause more of a problem. So I'm really upset with Morgan to even not monitor that or talk to the police or talk to or rape those people that is look for something to do. And believe it or not, in every community, there's always a group that wants to cause a problem, salute, you know, and burn stuff down because they don't have nothing no way. So they want to just, you know, out of, you know, frustration and all.
Go ahead.
Bring out our politicians. They need to come out. Every time it's a protest, they need to come there and take notes and see what's going on and take it to the next level. But by them being, you know, behind the scene and not addressing these young people's problems and the elderly people or anybody's problems, you know, and everything. So until that happens, we're going to have some serious problems. And going to war and killing and cutting, you know, burning stuff down, that's not the answer.
I'm glad you raised that. Let's talk about the tactics. Willie, I'll let you begin. You were there?
Okay, so I'm gonna start with Ferguson and then move to Baltimore. One, the so-called rioting and looting that happened in Ferguson was actually in two very small areas, and it was stopped by said protesters, right? It was not those who have been out there every day. And they protected stores, and they do call out those who don't act within the code of conduct. They do it very easily. And so I want to dispel that narrative. And if you're getting your information from majority mainstream media, most likely your perspective is skewed, and I would advise you to follow those who are on the ground who are reporting pretty non-biased for those who are involved in the media. I mean, in the movement, that would be my advisory to all people who are paying attention to what's going on, or at least check both sides of the story and confirm your facts that way. In Baltimore, one, protest is meant to inconvenience people. That is the purpose of civil disobedience. Its purpose is to inconvenience people, to make them understand that this is an issue, and also to put pressure on them and others that this is not business as usual. We are putting pressure there so that we can achieve whatever the demands and goals are of that, you know, protest, that movement, right? I was on 83. There was no fence. There was no violence to get there. We walked up 83. Like, we walked and we marched and we chanted, right? There was no violence for that to happen. And when there were instances of tension, the protesters, again, we checked each other because when we're in this movement, we are a family, we're moving from a space of love, and we have to respect each other and understand that if we're out here together, we have to be unified.
The caller's comment is such an important one because it really focuses on the heart of the matter here. And the tearing down of the fence was actually in Los Angeles, not on 83. But the caller's comment focuses on the problem. And Ferguson must not only be an absence of violence. It must represent the presence of justice. And if it doesn't, we have dropped the ball as American citizens, because Americans must be about justice. Justice for everyone. So when you look at Ferguson and what's going on, I agree with you, Mark. This is a moment in time that we must capture and not let go. I don't know whether Michael Brown is a hero or not. We need all the facts. But clearly he is a symbol. He's a symbol of the injustice that is occurring against black males in the criminal justice system. And as that symbol, we need to make sure that we do something about it, that we stop it now rather than allow this stuff to continue. And there are ways that we can do that. And we must act now. We must get the federal government, state and local governments, and activists to, in fact, make sure that we make some changes here in the criminal justice system. And it can be done. I mean, people are acting like there's nothing we can do. There's a whole lot we can do, and there's a whole lot that folks agree on. I mean, liberals and conservatives, as the commenter from Pittsburgh was talking about earlier, there's a whole lot of conservatives, of moderate Republicans that would agree with specific changes such as body cameras on police officers. That's something easily that can be done and that will make a huge difference.
Let me just say, unless you want to jump in, Michelle, I'm going to read this piece. One of my producers, Mark Henry, was also at the protest, chatted over here. Also, when we were blocking the entrance ramp to 83, there were people whose cars were blocked who were coming out of their cars with their hands up in solidarity. I've been on a lot of protests where people block traffic, and this is the only time I saw people whose cars were blocked really respecting the solemnity of the situation. So that's an interesting kind of piece as well, and I think that this has affected a lot of people. I mean, a lot of people very emotionally what has happened in this country, and I think that there's a confluence here of how it has affected community people emotionally and what it has released in terms of the contradictions in our own society that are beginning to be – people are paying attention to. This is a very – I do believe this is a very important moment. Where we go with it, what happens is another question, but it's a very important moment. 410-319-8888. Ernest, you're on the air.
To you and your guests.
Welcome.
Now, this is what the problem. The problem to me is this. They did not process the police that were on the scene, the homicide, the medical examiner. Nobody did what they were supposed to do. They didn't process the scene. They didn't mark off the scene. They didn't point out any of the evidence. They let the police walk around, wash itself off by itself, take his gun into the station. This never happens. No police report. So it was collusion right from the start. They did this so that the police could get away with this. Then it went to the district attorney, and then with the grand jury. He didn't have to panel a grand jury for this. He could have indicted him right off the bat. Now, and he had his two assistants, attorney, explain to them and confuse the grand jury, or whether they were confused or not. They wasn't going to indict.
Yeah, we talked about all this earlier in the show, right?
Yeah, but this is the problem. In the Abner Luena case, they did the same thing to a certain extent in New York when Abner Luena was sodomized in the police station.
Right.
What the federal government did, they went through everybody's phone. Everybody's phone and checked everybody out, found out who they were talking to, and they brought them in and found out it was the same type of collusion. Then they said, well, if you don't give us no information, we're going to charge you also. And then when they start talking about charging the police, then they started giving up information. This is why those officers was charged. So unless the federal government get right down to the brass facts and get everybody that colluded and obstructed justice in this case, then this will continue to happen. You notice that when they kill people, they don't stop killing people. They get worse. Trayvon Martin, a 12-year-old boy. The police did it. You know that was a setup. It wasn't like they was afraid if he had a gun. Because police, I've been in law enforcement, you don't pull right up onto a person if you think they're armed with a gun. And then when you look at the boy, he's 12 years old. And then you're going to immediately shoot. In New York, in a hallway, a 28-year-old boy shot.
So, Ernest, let me ask what your point is to get into the so people can our panel can comment before we run out of time.
Point is this: the federal government should charge everybody in the case, including the state's attorney and assistant state's attorneys, that criminally obstructed justice, knowingly and criminally obstructed justice. Okay,
let me ask you, Michael Higginbotham, how do you respond to that as somebody who's worked for these federal cases before? Is that possible?
The short answer is, unfortunately, it's unlikely to happen. I agree with the caller that we cannot have police officers acting as judge, jury, and executioner. I agree. I agree with the caller that Darren Wilson cannot be given a pass simply because he's a police officer. He needs to go to trial. We need to have all the facts come out. But unfortunately, the federal government is limited in terms of what it can do. There's going to be civil rights investigations of whether or not Michael Brown's civil rights were violated. It's a very limited, narrow statute, and so the Justice Department's hands are going to be tied. Unfortunately, the Brown family may bring a civil suit. Even though you didn't have an indictment of the police officer, they can still bring a civil suit. There's a different standard of evidence required, and they could be successful in terms of getting money damages for the harm that was done to their son. With that said, there's not much else that can be done except in terms of the future as to increasing the diversity of the police department, making sure that it reflects the racial makeup of the community, changing the grand jury process, removing people from office. I mean, these things can be done, but they're future. Unfortunately, there's not much that will be done in terms of prosecuting the police officer for the death here of Michael Brown.
Michelle?
Yeah, I mean, I think unfortunately there's so much there's such a lack of accountability on all levels of government, and you know, that's been incredibly apparent in the whole process. I just wanted to raise one point of something that happened recently, which was the delegation of people from Ferguson, including Mike Brown's parents, that went to the UN to present their story, and there were also people from Chicago there talking about police brutality, especially with the police misuse of tasers. And they also raised the point of the way the police responded in excessive force to protesters, for example, shooting rubber bullets into crowds and not telling people to disperse, and just having so much tear gas in residential areas where there weren't even protesters mobilized. So I think, whether that's more of a symbolic gesture or, the U.S. will really be held accountable on an international stage, I think that was a really powerful moment, because in the United States, we're raised to think that this is like the moral compass of the universe, and it's not. We can't look at our justice system as this model. And I think them going to the UN was, just a reminder that there is in some sense a higher authority, or, there are other eyes watching. And I think especially when you look at the civil rights movement, the international pressure, or just the shame that the country brought from hosing down its citizens in the streets. We see that again, where there is that international solidarity, and I think questions are starting to be raised of, like, how is the United States this huge power in the world and always policing other countries, yet we still have these problems where black youth are getting gunned down in the street, and in addition to that, the police are coming in and dealing with peaceful protesters like they're armed militants, which they're not. So, I mean, I just wanted to raise that point.
Those are important points. 410-319-8888. Let's go to who's waiting online here? Leo in Bolton Hill, you're on the air.
Hello, Mark Steiner.
Leo Bull. How are you, Leo?
I'm wonderful. Good morning to you and all your guests. I wonder if your guests know, and I'm fully in accord with what they're doing in Ferguson and throughout the country, do they know that we in Baltimore City have more than 100 cases of police brutality pending in this city? I just wonder if people know that. Baltimore is one of the capitals of police brutality in this country. I'm going to say I'm so proud of the students at Morgan and others, the People's Assembly and the Southern Christian Leadership Conference and everyone else who have engaged in civil disobedience. If the online community organizations, or I should say civil rights organizations in this country, and this state of Maryland had been doing what they should have been doing, if the legislators, whether they be Black Caucus or legislated Black Caucus, were doing what they should be doing, we wouldn't be at this point in time. And I want to remind everybody of that. This cup is boiling over because of the systemic institutional racism that exists, and I would hope that folks march on Annapolis, the Annapolis General Assembly meeting the second week in January of this year here in Maryland, to change this police officer's Bill of Rights, which gives the police officer more rights in Maryland and throughout this country than the citizens who pay their salaries. I wonder about that.
Well, that is a program we're going to have a number of conversations about leading up to our Annapolis summit, what's happening in Annapolis this year, and that will be an issue. Not just body cameras, but the Policeman's Bill of Rights and the possibility of civilian review boards, and those things are directly connected. You can't have one. You cannot have a civilian review board in Baltimore City unless the Police Officer's Bill of Rights is redone and rewritten, because that blocks the possibility of that. So that's a very serious and important subject.
And the Baltimore Sun, I think, did an investigation on this police brutality in Baltimore
right.
City. It was an excellent article, gathered some statistics, very convincing. And hopefully there'll be a strong response in terms of, one, maybe requiring all this information to be made public when things happen. I think that was actually already done. And then, two, maybe lifting the cap on liability for wrongful deaths committed
right.
by the police.
Right. And did you also, maybe you said this, I might have misunderstood it. Also, one of the things that with this law is, if once you've made a deal, you're not allowed to speak about what happened to you?
There are gag orders that can be put on those
right.
agreements, and there should not be.
The Baltimore Block definitely is aware of all the cases of police brutality. And when we protest here in Baltimore, we definitely do it in solidarity, not only with Ferguson, but also talking about the issues that we have here and those here who have been killed because of police brutality. Because, again, I think I said this earlier, Ferguson is everywhere, and it starts with our issues here. Because Mike Brown he's not the only person this happened to. He is a symbol for it boiling over and people standing up. But this isn't the first time people have protested a wrongful death by the police. The West family, Tyrone West, they do West Wednesdays every Wednesday at different locations around the city. They're at like 490-some-odd days protesting consecutively. So this isn't not only a national movement, but again, it is a very local and very grassroots movement.
And I think that's what we're seeing around the country, that these local movements are popping up, I mean, all across America. You've been covering this and talking about this a lot, Michelle.
I'm living in Los Angeles right now, and I was really encouraged just to see so many people come out. And again, like a very diverse group of people, certainly led by the youth. And if there's one thing I can note on moving forward, I would just say a lot of my faith and hope in the movement really does stem from the diversity of the movement. And I mean that even within the Black community itself, because I think, whenever you have voices marginalized, even within a specific group, it weakens the movement. At some point, you stop wanting to fight and stand up when your own issues aren't even addressed. And I think, again, echoing on what Radleek was saying, Black Lives Matter is really has been a huge force in making this an intersectional issue and making sure that Black women and Black LGBTQ folks have a strong voice in the movement, and they're not being silenced. And that's incredibly important, because their strength and their voices are needed for longevity, as well as, allies from other communities as well. Yeah.
Do we have time? Let's try to get one more call in here. 410-319-8888. Clarence, you're on the air.
Hey, thank you, Mr. Steiner. For the moment, I'm going to take the racial aspect out of what I'm about to say, and I hope you find this worthy of an answer. Where do we stand in this Mexican standoff when you have the subservient, the police department, law enforcement, protect and serve, using excessive violence against the people as in what's going on now, and the law failing to rein them in, and the political system, what I'm terming the government, failing and refusing to take any corrective matters, and the people are saying enough is enough. Where in history, if you history, where what has always been the outcome of such a situation? And I believe wholeheartedly that the political Republican Democrat government refuses to do this because part of their existence, maintaining their own hegemony and power structure, is based on suppression of a certain part of this society.
Thank you, Clarence. I mean, I think you're right. I mean, that's why I say we're at a very interesting cusp in the political social life of America, and where this takes us. Because I think that you are seeing that in this country now, that there is a movement afoot. The question is, where does it go, and what effect will it have? Can it push to oust people in office? Can it push to actually change the system? Can it push to create a sense of what race means in America, to begin to change that dynamic in a positive sense in this country? Can that happen? We don't know.
And the history of racial progress in this country has been one that ebbs and flows. And as the caller mentioned, what has transpired in the past, there has been some progress made, but there also has been some reversion. And I think this is a moment in time. We've got to make sure that we don't go back, that we go forward, and that we make substantive changes that can make it safe for everyone, and that all life, whether it's black, white, brown, or yellow, is valued equally in our criminal justice system.
Well, we're looking here to see where the movement's going, but continues conversations in the air. You just heard the voice of F. Michael Higginbotham, the Dean Joseph Curtis Professor of Law at the University of Baltimore School of Law, author of Ghosts of Jim Crow, Ending Racism in Post-Racial America. Raleigh Case has been in the studio with us for the entire 2 hours as well. Board President of the Baltimore Algebra Project. Always good to have him in the studio. This will be a frequent guest on that. You'll be hearing his voice a lot. And visiting us in town here, Michelle Zay, activist, producer, and journalist. Good to have you in the studio as well. Thank you all for coming in today.
Can I respond, or?
We only have, like, 10 seconds.
Okay. just quickly, I would say don't tell oppressed people how to be oppressed or how to react to that. That's not anybody's place, to be honest. And then also just the history of the movement is that we've always demonized those who have rebelled against the system until after they won. And that's just been the history of movements in general. So, yeah.
Ruddy Case, thank you so much for those closing thoughts. Reminding you on your way out of here, the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information at www.mecu.com. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Stephanie Mavronis and Mark Gunnery. Our engineer is Andrea Melton. Our intern is Sienna Greaves. Our new theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. On our way out of here, Marching to Ferguson, a song by artist Tom Morello, who was formerly of the band Rage Against the Machine. Rolling Stone reported Tom Morello has pledged that the proceeds from the single will help benefit protesters arrested in the Michael Brown shooting aftermath. And to hear the show again, podcast any of our past shows, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. You can also download all of our podcasts now on iTunes. And for Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Stay involved. Take care. A nation in hell.